log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah. Today's great tip: what are the secrets of ubudiyya, of the servitude of Allah, in the words of Imam Khomeini? Now, dear listeners, we find that when talking about ubudiyya, when talking about the servitude of Allah, the worship of Allah, the obedience of Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, Imam Khomeini says, try to tint and color the movements and the stillness of your heart and your body with a divine spiritual color, a divine spiritual tint. And remember to serve the creatures of Allah just because of their being the creatures of Allah. Dear friends, this is such a subtle but important point that whatever our actions are, whatever our movements are, whatever things we do in our life, we need to try our best to color them and tint them and give this manifestation to these acts of worship and to this ubudiyya with a divine spiritual color. We shouldn't just do our actions in a mundane and meaningless and useless manner. Rather, we should have a clear and firm intention upon the things we do. And not only should our intention in our ubudiyya be clear and be sincere and be pure, but it also needs to have a divine, a spiritual color to it. Our actions should not be limited to the worldly materialistic desires or merely materialistic intentions or the profit and gain of this world. And in the next part, Imam Khomeini says, to serve creatures, to help creatures, to be of service and help to creatures just because they are Allah's creatures. It's a very interesting point here, but we shouldn't serve Allah's creatures because of some sort of selfish profit. They might help us somewhere along the line. They might give us a promotion. They might be nicer to us, or any other kind of selfish, individualistic desire. No, rather, we serve the creatures of Allah. We help the creatures of Allah just because they are the creatures of Allah.
In the name of Allah, assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to this segment of the program, Foresight. My name is Muhammad, and today I would like to read to you the English translation of an excerpt from Munajatul Dhakirin, The Whispered Prayer of the Rememberers. Please stay with me. My God, love-mad hearts are enraptured by you. Disparate intellects are brought together by knowing you. Hearts find no serenity except in remembering you. Souls find no rest except in seeing you. You are the glorified in every place, the worshipped at every time, the found at every moment, the called by every tongue, the magnified in every heart. I pray forgiveness from you for every pleasure but remembering you, every ease but intimacy with you, every happiness but nearness to you, every occupation but obeying you. My God, you have said, and your word is true. O you who have faith, remember God with much remembrance and glorify Him at dawn and in the evening. And you have said, and your word is true, remember me and I will remember you. You have commanded us to remember you and promised that you will remember us thereby in order to ennoble, respect, and honor us. Here we are, remembering you as you have commanded us. So accomplish what you have promised us, O rememberer of the rememberers, O most merciful of the merciful.
Welcome back, dear listeners, in continuation to what we were talking about, which was these secrets of ubudiyah, of the servitude of Allah, which can be found in the esteemed words of the esteemed Imam Khomeini. We had just talked about how we should color our movements and our actions with a divine spiritual color, and we should try to attain the peace and the calmness of the heart and the body. And of course that we should serve the creatures of Allah, not because of some selfish motive or some ulterior motive, but rather because they are the creatures of Allah, they are the creations of Allah, and they deserve due respect. In another place, we find that Imam Khomeini, when talking about these secrets of ubudiyah, these secrets of worship and servitude of Allah, he says that until the eyes of the hearts penetrate through the partitions of light so as to reach the origin of greatness and our souls become hanging on to the glory of Allah's sanctity. It's very beautiful, dear brothers and sisters, dear listeners. We find how Imam Khomeini has this very spiritual aspect, and really it is as if he is exposing and disclosing these wonderful secrets of ubudiyah and these secrets of the servitude of Allah. So here, first and foremost, he talks about the eyes of the heart. Now, dear friends, we need to realize that we have these physical and material eyes on our head, and you know, we can see the world via these eyes. But it is the eyes of the heart and the eyes of the soul from which a human being can truly see and witness and feel, comprehend, realize the realities of the cosmos. And so, dear friends, here we are being requested to open the eyes of our hearts, to open the eyes of our souls, until they can go through and penetrate through the partitions of light to reach the origin of greatness. And what is this origin of greatness? What is this source of greatness? What is the ultimate greatness? What is the true greatness manifested in this cosmos? Of course, as we say, Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar. God is great. Allah is the origin of greatness. And finally, in this little part of the statement that we have from Imam Khomeini talking about ubudiyyah, talking about the servitude of Allah, he says that our souls will eventually hang on to, cling, hold fast upon the glory of Allah's sanctity. It is via our soul and the obedience of the body to the soul, the obedience of the heart to the soul, the obedience of the intellect to the soul, then purification, and eventually all of this leads to our soul becoming connected, hanging on to, holding fast upon the glory of the sanctity of Allah. Welcome back, dear friends. This is Foresight on IRIB English Radio. We've been talking about the secrets of ubudiyyah, the secrets of the servitude of Allah, in the wise words of the esteemed Imam Khomeini, and we talked about how we should color our movements and our actions with the divine and spiritual color, and how we should serve the creatures of Allah because they are the creatures and creations of Allah. We talked about how just as we have eyes in our heads, we also have eyes in our hearts. And it is through the eyes of the hearts and the purification of the body and the soul that we reach to the sanctity of Allah. In this final segment, there's a very interesting and beautiful and profound statement from Imam Khomeini talking about ubudiyyah and really showing us these secrets of the servitude of Allah, where he says, in his most exalted name, in his most exalted name, alas, my life has passed in vain, loaded with sins, with no devotional gain. Tomorrow, when I am brought to the scene of judgment, they will say that repentance, chance, did not remain. In this very short but profound and beautiful and deep and spiritual statement regarding ubudiyyah, because this is one of the manifestations of ubudiyyah, is how we should really remember and keep in mind that life passes so quickly. Life flies by. Time is a thing that no one can hold on to, similar to the grains of sand which drift and fall between the fingers of a human being. And how many sins are there that we have committed? We are loaded with sins, we are loaded with errors, we are loaded with disobedience. Is it not time for us to ask for forgiveness? And it is these sins which prevent us and keeps us away from the servitude of Allah. And likewise, it is forgiveness which allows us to be free and fly towards the Almighty, the Exalted? And what worship and what servitude have we truly done in our lives? Can we really count all of the things that we have done? And even if we were to be able to count all the things that we have done when it comes to the servitude of Allah and the ubudiyah of Allah, how much have we done in respects to how much Allah deserves? And finally, we must remember, if we want to increase and enhance our ubudiyah, increase and enhance our worship and our servitude of Allah, we must remember today and always that we will be brought to the scene of judgment, the day of judgment, in which at that point in time there will be no opportunity to come back and do more good deeds and refrain from bad deeds, to ask for forgiveness, to thank Allah, for time on that day will run out.
Ilaha. عاد لك مليك كل لمن ملك لبيك قد لبيت لك.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Since the onset of the bloody war on Yemen, the United Kingdom has always insisted that it's not a party to the Saudi-led campaign. Despite all the denials, the British military has always been playing a key role in maintaining the Saudi war machine, especially in training, advising, and supplying the Saudi Air Force bombing the country. New documents have shed further light on the corners of this sinister cooperation. Declassified UK has now discovered that Britain has a secret detachment of up to 30 troops in Yemen, where they are training Saudi forces in the middle of the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe.
Well, it should be hugely significant given what it uncovers, British complicity in torture, which goes back many years. Britain was a key player in the Bush administration's war on terror, helping with rendition and torture. We know this. The cases were brought to court in this regard. But sadly, we have a crisis of our news media in the UK. This story has not been picked up by any of the mainstream media organisations, the BBC, ITV, Sky News, etc. And so the public is not being made aware of these revelations. Declassified UK has done a great job since it was established in investigating the dark and murky corners of British foreign policy. But it's not receiving its due coverage in the mainstream media, because we don't have a media which in a normal democracy is it has a mission of holding the powerful to account on behalf of the people. We today in Brexit Britain have a media that sees its role, a mainstream media that sees its role as holding the people to account on behalf of the powerful.
The British personnel are reportedly based at Al Rayda Airport in Mahra province of eastern Yemen. The troops are believed to have been there for several months. In the words of Hamid Zabnout, a tribal sheikh in Mahra, the tasks assigned to them so far are military training and logistical support, either for Saudi forces or Saudi-backed militia that are elements from the Southern Transitional Council, a Yemeni separatist group. Local sources say the British troops are flown into the airport by Saudi military aircraft and bypass normal visa checks. Since the Saudis have banned mobile phones inside the airport, it is almost impossible to film or photograph the British troops. In an interview with Britain's ambassador Michael Aaron in late June, Yemen's Al Mahria TV channel repeatedly questioned him over allegations of UK forces having been seen in the east of the country. This is how the British ambassador replied.
مكافحة التحريض وهذا كان موقفنا من زمان عندنا علاقات جيدة ووثيقة مع الحكومة الشرعية.
Fighting terrorism with up to 30 forces in a country existentially threatened by the Saudi-led war is a claim dismissed by many as untenable.
Well, they're there to aid the state terrorism that's been unleashed by the Saudis on the people of Yemen. That's very clear. This is doublethink on the part of the British ambassador, Mr. Aitken. This is them trying to justify something that cannot be justified by saying that they're fighting terrorism. When you're on the side of the Saudis fighting terrorism, then you have to take a sharp look at yourself in the mirror. The Saudis practice terrorism. This is less a country and more a family business whose primary business is murder. Just ask the widow of Jamal Khashoggi. Or his bereaved fiancée, rather, if you want that confirmed. Never mind the thousands of people who are routinely executed in that kingdom of blood. So Mr. Aitken is, again, showing his true colours, not as an ambassador of the British democracy, but as an ambassador of British state crimes abroad. The Saudis have unleashed hell on Yemen since 2015. It's a disaster for the people of Yemen. Thousands and thousands have died. People have suffered famine, disease. Thousands of children have died every single day, and the British are up to their neck in blood, in Yemeni blood. That's the reality.
Bat Khalashat, a provincial deputy for youth affairs, estimates that Saudi and Western forces have built more than 100 underground cells inside the airport. Rights organizations say Saudi forces run a prison camp inside the airport, in which detainees are subject to cruel torture or degrading treatment. According to Geneva-based advocacy group SAM for Rights and Liberties, Yemenis are being tortured by the British-backed Saudi forces at the airport.
Bertolt Brecht, the great German playwright from the 1930s and 40s, said it best. The crimes pile up so high they become invisible. And the crimes of the British state have become so invisible because there are so many of them, and that people are distracted by tittle-tattle, by the identity politics, by celebrity, by sport, etc. But this is a sordid turn of events when you have British military personnel, a country that likes to consider itself a pillar of human rights and stability and standing for everything good in the world, has its own military personnel complicit in the torture of Yemeni nationals. It's a disgrace.
Whereas the Saudi-imposed blockade has left millions of Yemeni civilians on the brink of famine, turning the airport into a prison where arbitrary detention and torture are practiced, all with the help of the British, indicates how far London is willing to go in support of authoritarian regimes such as Riyadh. According to SAM's president, Tawfiq Al-Hamidi, Saudi forces operate the airport's prison where they receive logistical support and military training by British troops stationed at the airport since the beginning of this year.
Britain is playing a material role in the war in Yemen. British soldiers have been training Saudi troops who are destined to go to Yemen to fight. British RAF personnel have been helping Saudi's air war against Yemen. They've been helping with targeting. They've been helping with the equipment. They've been helping to maintain equipment. They are deeply embedded with Saudi's war effort in Yemen. And again, it's a disgrace. Again, it's iniquitous. But again, it's no surprise given where Britain is culturally and politically in this post-Brexit landscape.
Meanwhile, as of February this year, British officials authorized the export of almost £1.4 billion worth of weapons to Saudi Arabia in the quarter after the UK resumed sales of weapons, generating public outrage.
It's all about money. It's all about money. Human rights is but a fig leaf when it comes to money. Britain's relationship with the Saudis. Britain enjoys a symbiotic security and defence relationship with the Saudis. They train Saudi RAF pilots. Saudi military officers are trained at SANTERS, Britain's renowned officer training school in the UK. They're on the ground in Saudi Arabia. They run train and equip operations. They maintain Saudi's air force. There are billions and billions in arms sold from the UK to the Saudis. Indeed, the Saudis are Britain's single biggest customer for recipient of US arms. And it's all about money. It's a source of revenue. And even more so now, Britain is desperate for revenue after leaving the EU, and so it's willing to go to plumb even lower depths than it already has when it comes to propping up these unsavoury regimes in order to benefit financially from them.
The detention and torture of Mahra residents is just another horror to add to the list of the Saudi-led coalition's unlawful conduct in Yemen. But it's also another case in which the British government is aiding and abetting Saudi Arabia to go on with its inhumane crimes, putting profit before Yemeni lives.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. Welcome to Islamic Upbringing at IRIB English Radio. We talk about things that we might encounter in our daily lives, specifically with our children. In this program, our sources are the Quran and the traditions that we have from the Ahlul Bayt. We've got Brother Abdullah Al-Musubi today with us, and we're glad to have him here. Let's welcome him to our program. Salaamu Alaikum, brother. Welcome to English Radio.
Wa Alaikum Assalam wa Rahmatullahi wa Barakatuh. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is all ours, and we do look forward to seeing you again and again and again. The thing is, one thing leads to another thing, right? So in our previous programs, we talked about democracy, and we did explain what we mean by democracy. By the way, if you missed out on that program, go to our website, pastoday.com, and you'll find the episodes there. Today, I think we should... for example, like, it's a child, right? And the child might see and might feel uncomfortable when it's that the democracy that he needs is not being given to them. There is this inherited, if I may say, mentality within parents that they have got this habit, you know, they just order and they are dictators, right? What can be done as a society and as individuals for us to get rid of this mentality and deal with it in a manner?
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجه. So when we said that we need to teach our kids democracy, we don't mean that we give them the absolute freedom to do whatever they want, whatever time they want, in whatever way they want. This is not what we're saying. We're saying you need to give them a voice, give them the bit of respect, so they feel like they are individual, and then they could communicate with you. This method it creates in them that to respect the opinion of other people and not become, as we call, dictators.
As right. as you elaborated right. in the previous right. session.
An ayah in the Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, and it is very beautiful ayah, he says, أَمْرُهُمْ شُورَ بَيْنَهُمْ. Right? Mm-hmm. Their affair is a counseling between them.
Right.
And okay. the word أَمْرُهُمْ is a very sensitive word, because sometimes people mistranslate this word. They said, well, everything, it's even in, for example, even choosing a leader, a khalifa, is shura, is a council between us.
Mm.
Allah says, no, أَمْرُهُمْ, your affairs, not my affairs. Leadership yeah. is my effort.
Yeah.
إِنِّي جَعْلُ
فِي That's not of your business.
Yeah, I place a khalifa. This out of you. Things that concern you, make it a shura, make it a council between you guys. Today, what we call is, you know, the parliament is basically this is the shura counseling. They sit together and they decide what they want. And instead of having just one person dictating how everyone should live or what should happen to everybody, right? If we teach our kids that, you know, that kind of shura in Islam, they will become better, easy people. They will become you know, free thinkers. They won't become dictators. For example, and this is something that we need to begin teaching our kids from a young age, right? For example, you want to take your child to the park, for example. You say to him, which park should we go to? You give him choice, right? Giving him choice, meaning that you're giving him freedom, you're giving him responsibility, you're giving him making him feel that he's an individual. He's not just a follower. He's not just a sheep. He's, you know, someone who has a say.
Yeah, that leads him.
It doesn't make a difference to you which park he goes to, but when you install this method in him, it makes him feel a lot better. What time should we go? What back should we take? What sort of food should we take?
I mean, bright individuals in our society are actually formed from that core and significant manner that you just mentioned. We're going to carry on about this and we'll return shortly after this break. Please stay tuned.
When I was born, the first words that I had heard were the words of Allah being whispered through my ear. And as I felt Allah's presence in my soul, that day Islam took me in its fold.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We're talking about Amruhum Shura Bainahum, as Brother translated. And you're elaborating on that. Something as small as going to a park, is it?
It is, because we're dealing with kids, right? So we need to bring the things that they deal with themselves to their level. I mean, I'm not going to talk to them about something that's higher than they could comprehend. This is maybe ideal with other people, which we should, which we don't do, sadly. That's one of the problems.
Mm-hmm.
But with our kids, that's why we have to start from the beginning. So we, for example, they want to buy toys. They like toys. You give them that option. Okay, we have certain toys. Which toy would you like? That, you know, just ask him that question, what would you like? Where should we go? That flexibility and option, it grows in the child a sense not just that he's respected, but to respect other people. And this is what we're trying to get at. This is what we're trying to say that when it comes to democracy. So like I said, or like you said, it's as simple as choosing a park, choosing a place to eat, choosing where to go, choosing the time, choosing a place. And so these things, this is what the child grows with. But as he grows older and older, it becomes embedded into him.
For example, we say those, for example, those who play soccer, right? Those who always trying to score a goal, they never give a pass.
We hate those people.
Yeah, so their mindset is what? They've been brought up in a sense where, no, I can do it. You know, I'm not going to, I think we'll disregard everyone else. And this is the dictatorship ideology, where people who actually always, you know, he will give a pass at the, you know, at the first instant he find passable, he passes the ball. That person brought up with the concept of shura, right?
Yeah, so something as small as a football game, you can see how you've been brought
up. Well, this is how psychology works. This is how psychologists determine what type of person you are through the things that you do in your life. And say, okay, you do this, such a thing, which means this concept went wrong in your life, or this is happening in your life. For example, when you dissect a dictator, for example, Hitler, for example, or Mussolini or Saddam Hussein, you see that in their childhood, things went wrong.
Certainly
and,
did.
And it changed the way they think, right? So that's why we say, well, from an Islamic point of view, when Allah says, Amrum Shura Bainahum, you give them that ability to choose so they don't become dictators, because we don't want that. We had so many of them.
Yeah, we've had enough.
And these guys just cause bloodshed and, you know. So we don't want that. So we begin with our kids with the smallest things. Sometimes even the way you arrange their rooms. Like, what would you like your bed? In here or here?
What color bed sheet do you want?
Well, accent. Yeah. Small things. But to the child, they are, you know,
major things. It's decision making.
Actually, they are very fundamental to him. And like you, this is where you plant your seeds and you build your pillars that will, you know, that the child will, as he grows old, will rely on. So this is when we say democracy goes against a dictatorship in that sense.
Yeah,
we
see that it's something very natural for children, because even toddlers who can't even speak, for example, they've placed a toy somewhere and you just move it like a couple of inches. They do not like that. They just put it back where they wanted to put it, right?
Exactly.
So that's something that's within them. We'll carry on about this and see what else we can get out of the questions that we have today. Please stay tuned, dear listeners.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We are talking about how we put democracy and the mentality within the child. And we have done that in the previous program. One question that remains for us is, for those people who still have, as parents, this the mentality that whatever I say is right, as you say, my way or the highway, what can be done to convince these people, you know, to change their minds and approach?
Okay, convincing people, it's not an easy task itself.
No,
right?
It isn't.
Because convincing itself requires democracy, requires leniency. But as parents, because me and you, we are parents, for example, we have kids, and our concern is the well-being of our child mentally and physically, right? We want to have a good child. That's our aim. So you, as a parent, as an educator, you have to make it your mission to always find ways to bring your child in a good manner. So this is your mission in life, right?
Yeah.
So your mission is to learn why, so you can have a good child. Because if I become stubborn and say, you know what, it's okay, my child, he'll become good, and I leave it to chance, then obviously you're shooting your child in the head,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You're just killing him mentally. You're just killing that child. So if you love your child and you want your child to have a proper upbringing, then you are required to do it, to make some changes, as simple as that. And changes sometimes, I mean, for example, let's take an example. Let's say a parent who's all his life has been giving orders, now he wants to change. Sure, you can change. It takes time. It takes patience. Like we mentioned in the other episode, we mentioned the ayah from the Quran. Allah says, وَأَمَرْ أَهْلَكَ بِالصَّلَاةِ. Give you orders, give orders to follow them to pray. وَاسْتَبَرْ عَلَيْهَا. It requires patience.
Mm-hmm.
So change your vocabulary, right? Change the way you talk. Just change that. and patience. And slowly, slowly, you will see the difference. Mm-hmm. If you have a stubborn child that never listens to you, and I'm telling you right now, he's not listening to you because you're giving him orders. And that's it. As simple as that. He's not listening to you because he hates orders. Don't watch TV. Turn off the game. Do this. Do that. They hate that. Mm. For example, if you have a child that plays a lot of games, for example, constantly on the console and he just don't want to let it go. Instead of saying to him, turn it off, don't play anymore, and you create like a backlog of, I don't know, black holes in his brain, say to him, how about we choose times for you to play? Or how about we put a schedule for your playing? Or how about this and how about that, right? And then he's like, yeah, sure, why not? I'm going to voice my opinion. So since I can't say what I want to say, then yeah, sure. I don't mind playing from 5 to 6, for example, or in the afternoon. Or this way, you got to your point, but he done it himself. Mm-hmm. So as a parent, like I said, first, we are motivated. We're driven by the fact that we love our kids. We want to give them the best upbringing. And second is that we need to be patient.
Yeah, and the decisions that we make for them is only very limited by time, isn't it? Because how long are we going to make decisions for our children? Our children most likely will outlive us. And if we carry on doing this, the children, what about the times when we're not there? We're physically or in terms of either they outlive us or we are distant from them in time of space, you know, in terms of space. So, yeah, if we want them to be independent individuals, we might as well just start doing that right now when they're with us rather
than...
That's
it. Because once they hit teenage years, it's going to be too late.
Yeah, it's too late, yeah. And then we can just keep on banging ourselves on the head, and there is no outcome.
Which a lot of parents do these days.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, precisely. You see them doing that. I think we pretty much did conclude whatever we had to say about democracy, or what do you suggest? It's a conclusion, isn't it? Okay. So, if you've got any topics or any questions, please send them in at englishradio@irib.ir so we can elaborate and we can discuss and analyze what we can get out of those. Our website is parstoday.com, parstoday.com, in case you've missed out on our episodes and are interested in listening to them. And other social media is Call of Islam Radio, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. So we'll be waiting for your response and suggestions. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Aperture. Dow Chemical and DuPont are American chemical corporations. These two chemical giants have become the number one companies in the chemical sector. Today, they make billions of euros in profit, but behind this resounding success lies a dark secret, toxic contamination and pollution, which has affected thousands, causing disabilities, cancers, and even death. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. For decades, Dow Chemical and DuPont factories have been secretly dumping their toxic waste into rivers, groundwater systems, and soil, and keeping the tragic consequences a secret. Sadly, the constant exposure to toxic waste spares no one, neither the surrounding residents nor the company's employees. Stay with us as this week's documentary sheds light over years of lies and impunity through the analysis of samples in confidential documents.
Yeah, this is only a prayer. used to be up in there, keeping an eye, getting out of the head.
At the end of the 60s, Leotis Jones was a prisoner in Holmesburg, a suburb of Philadelphia in the United States. A prisoner, but also a guinea pig for industry, like thousands of other inmates.
H-Block, this is where all the medical testing, the human experimentation was going on.
How many times have you taken that corridor?
Oh, man, about maybe 25, 30 times. You know, but there was different tests that they was running. And sometimes I was on like two tests at a time, you know?
Okay.
This practice was confidential at the time because multinational chemical companies came here to test the risks of their products. To earn a few dollars, the prisoners participated in several tests, but none of them knew what they were being given.
What they would do, they would put the tape and stick it and pull it, stick it and pull it, stick it and pull it. Then they would put a drop in the substance, whatever it was that was in it, on that area.
And what happened after?
All over my body, my skin pigmentation got light in certain areas.
How long did it last?
About a year, somewhere around there. And they had you signing a paper stating that it was informed consent, but it was just a paper to waive them from being liable if anything go wrong.
One company did everything they could to keep this a secret. They even paid Leotis Jones for his silence. Dow Chemical. The leading manufacturer of plastics in the world and the third largest manufacturer of pesticides, Dow Chemical has an annual turnover of $48 billion and 50,000 employees around the globe. In the wake of this chemical giant, there's an industry of staggering profitability, an industry in a frantic race to innovate. Each year, their new toxic products reach the market. These multinationals all have one thing in common, a culture of secrecy.
You're following us.
Polluting lands, rivers, and groundwater. Behind the fumes of these factories, we have discovered tens of thousands of victims. In India, children are born with severe disabilities. In the U.S., those who have dedicated their lives to this industry...
Everybody wanted to go there because of, for the money, for the benefits, and it was secure.
...are now paying the price.
Those guys are all dead, and I should have been. Why'd they lie?
Faced with these tragedies, the chemical giants have adopted a specific course of action. Lack of transparency, cynicism, denial. In the meantime, they continue to reap the profits. In Holmesburg Prison, Dow experimented on the inmates with one of the most carcinogenic products in the world, dioxin. It's one of the molecules in Agent Orange, the powerful herbicide that Dow produced for the American Army during the Vietnam War. The Air Force dumped it on the Viet Cong for a decade. At the same time, the tests were being performed at Holmesburg. From that time on, Dow was already aware of the dangers of dioxin. The company put it in writing in this confidential note from June 1965. Dioxin is exceptionally toxic. Some months later, Dow would study its side effects on the prisoners.
Hey, man, what can I say? There's no way in the world if they would have informed us back then that we would participate. No. No, no, I wouldn't have. They were trying to cover it up. They wouldn't invite it up.
We found one of the doctors that performed the tests at Holmesburg in the 1960s. Today, he's an oncologist at Northwestern Hospital in Chicago. Since Sigmund Weitzman is preparing to retire. He is one of the few witnesses still alive.
Every day, I had a row of 20 convicts. They were coming in all day. So
all day long, people were coming.
Oh, absolutely. It was a machine.
In 1967, Sigmund Weitzman was only 21 years old. He was an intern at Holmesburg. The senior physician overseeing the tests never told him the names of the products used on the prisoners. He only realized later that he had administered dioxin to human beings. We show him what Dow knew back then about the chemical.
This cereal is exceptionally toxic. No wonder it's confidential. This is 50 years old.
Yeah.
It's very upsetting.
This is the first time you read these documents?
Yes.
I'm
appalled. I'm just very... It's so casual. I also felt personally guilty that I was participating in something so horrible. You don't give people poison. It's just simple. You know, as if these people aren't people. They're just experimental animals. Nowadays, it would be criminal.
Dow was never prosecuted. When prisoners tried to take action against the company, the statute of limitations had expired. This multinational would not only poison inmates with dioxin, but also tens of thousands of people in Midland, Michigan, in the north of the U.S. Midland, the birthplace of Dow.
Here at the Dow Chemical Company in Midland, Michigan, revolutionary chemical killers.
This is where Agent Orange was manufactured. Its production created waste extremely high in dioxin. Dow secretly dumped this waste into the river that flows through the city. In 1981, one man would discover the truth.
We had a conclusion there that Dow was a major source, if not the only source, to the river, and certainly to the community, and that people were at risk.
At the time, Milton Clark was a toxicologist for the EPA, the government agency responsible for environmental protection. With his colleagues, he wrote a report condemning Dow's practices. But right before the report's publication, the corporation would succeed in pressuring the acting chief of the EPA in Washington. Pressured by his superiors, Milton Clark was forced to censor the report. The result? Pollution in Midland, Michigan would continue for 30 years with impunity. And the executives at Dow would continue denying the dangers.
There is no health problem in Midland. There is absolutely no evidence of dioxin doing any damage to humans.
In 2006, one woman would attack the multinational again. At the time, Mary Gade oversaw all the offices at the Environmental Agency in the Midland region. She had leverage. She'd been nominated by the President of the United States, George W. Bush. Newly appointed, she demands that more testing be done in the city.
We found these astronomically high levels of dioxin, levels that my staff think may be some of the highest levels ever found in the United States. One of the things that was astonishing to me when this came to my attention was that for almost 30 years, this very serious problem had not actually been addressed.
Where have you found these high levels?
So yeah, we found it in yards alongside the river system, parks where children play, where people launch their boats, where fishermen put their boats in the water. This is where people live. So I immediately called Dow senior officials and said, we're very concerned about these levels. We need you to take action. As that unfolded, the company was not happy. It's extremely expensive to clean up this much contamination. Hundreds of millions of dollars, if not more.
To lodge a complaint, Dow goes directly to the White House.
I was asked on May 1st of 2008 to either resign or quit by the end of the day.
Okay.
Were you surprised?
Yes, very much so. In my 30-some years of working in environmental protection and much of that spent in the government, I would have never expected that. Dow was acting in its own interest, so Dow was trying to make sure that it saved as much money as possible.
As a result of these maneuvers, for decades, thousands of people have lived surrounded by dioxin without knowing the risks. We wanted to meet these victims. But in Midland, it's hard to loosen tongues. Dow has supported the city for 120 years, and reminders are at every corner. At the bank, the stadium, the library, the public park, the high school. The shadow of the company is everywhere. Only one person agreed to break the code of silence. Alice Buchelter has spent most of her life here, near the river. This is where she raised her family.
Oh, this is where we used to have the zip line way back here.
Okay.
We used to have all trails that went down through here. I don't even know if you can see any of them over here. But 18 years and the land is very fertile. And it was used for motocross trails and hiking trails and dune buggy trails and just, you know, recreation in the woods. For a kid, it was like a wonderland. It was, you know, an adventure. They could explore and they could build forts and they could do all those things.
No one advised you that there was dioxin down there?
Nope. We just thought we found a magical spot for us to play and raise a family.
For nearly 40 years, the Buchelter family would live here, blissfully unaware of their toxic surroundings. Every spring, the river floods their garden, bringing in a fresh wave of dioxin. Alice Buchelter would not discover the true extent of the contamination until 2007, when tests were conducted in her garden by the local environmental agency. The levels of dioxin were up to 17 times higher than the legal limit for toxicity.
I have, my oldest daughter has autoimmune diseases.
You have five kids?
Mm-hmm.
How many of them do have autoimmune disease?
I would say all of them. Some to a lesser degree and some to a more severe degree. And my husband had a very malignant colon cancer. It was a real quick onset.
Her late husband, Herbert Buchelter, was a doctor. A few days before he passed away, he expressed a last wish.
He was brave enough to, when he was dying, to have his blood drawn when he didn't have very much blood left. Dioxin levels were taken the Thursday before he died on a Sunday. He was willing to do it to ascertain that there was a connection. The results of my husband's, this is his levels.
These are the actual breakdown.
Alex Buchelter's husband had 64.5 nanograms of dioxin per liter of blood, three times the U.S. average.
We had been married 46 years when he died. And would I have treasured 10 more years? Yeah. And, you know, that's been a major impact on my life.